I'm Kirsten Moorhead, and I am the only daughter of Michael. I am 34 years old. I was 9 months old at the time of Elizabeth's murder, and I have been able to mark the decades of my life by how long this cold case has gone on. I am currently not in contact with my parents. I'm an artist. I quit my day job to be an artist full time. So that's been really fun. I guess that's the elevator pitch.
Over the course of this series, you've heard from many people whose lives were directly impacted by Elizabeth's murder. And most of them still feel that impact today. The children of the prime suspect were too young to know Elizabeth or understand what was happening in 1990. But just like with their father, Michael, and their mother, Jill, the shadow of Elizabeth's murder has haunted them their entire lives in a way that almost no one else has experienced. In the last episode, you heard Paul Koistra's letter, where he asks if everyone can just move on with their lives. But that wasn't possible for Michael and his family. Covenant may have been relieved for them to leave campus in 1990 and take the stigma of the murder with them. But that stigma and its effects didn't go away. So today you'll hear from two people whose lives were uniquely changed by the unsolved murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. This is True Believer, Episode 10, The Forgotten Children. Hey, Ruth.
Hey, TJ.
Okay, so this episode's going to be a little bit different than what we've done before. Talk about that a little bit.
This episode is less of a reported episode and more two extended interviews with two people who were very happy, were interested in sharing their stories, Carl and Kirsten. And we wanted to give them a space to share their stories and to share how the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh and the continued suspicion of their dad, Michael, affected them, not just in 1990, but really throughout their lives. We're just hoping that people give them a fair listen. You might hear things that bother you or frustrate you. They both have their own opinions about the church and the seminary. They're entitled to those opinions. And we wanted to give them a space where they could talk about that. And we're hoping that anybody interested in this project is willing to just sit down and hear and sit with kind of the weight and the emotions of their story.
The line from Ted Lasso comes to mind, be curious, not judgmental. And I'm saying that because unlike most of the previous episodes, we're not going to bleep anything. There's going to be some language and content that you'll hear that some people might consider offensive, but I'm leaving it in because I want people to feel the full weight of what Carl and Kirsten have to say.
Right. And just some housekeeping notes and a content warning for anybody listening. We will talk about allegations of domestic violence and child abuse really throughout the story of this episode. And so if that's tough for you, you really might want to just skip the whole episode. Michael and Jill have never been charged with a crime in connection to the murder of Elizabeth or anything else. We have reached out to Michael and Jill for interviews. They've declined to be interviewed at this time. You'll also hear other folks mentioned just in passing by Carl and Kirsten. We've also reached out to Brian Chappell and Paul Koistra for comment. They also have declined to be interviewed at this time.
So with that, we bring you Carl and Kirsten.
So my name is Carl St. Lucie. My father, Michael, is a prime suspect in the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh that happened, you know, March 26, 1990. I was 2 years old at the time. My sister was 9 months old. So, you know, this is a story that's and a case that's been with me my whole life. And I've known basically all of the details since I was 12. Over the years, I've done my own research and investigation around this and very briefly was working with Creve Coeur Police a few years ago and gave them some details that helped them to reopen the case. So yeah, it's a case that I have a lot of personal investment in just because it was a terrible, terrible thing that happened. And, you know, I do think that Elizabeth and her family and everyone else involved deserve justice, you know? When we talk about PTSD, right, like, typically, PTSD, we think of things like war veterans who like have a traumatic experience and they come back. And, you know, not to say that it's all one-off events in a wartime scenario, but like typically when we think of those, that kind of PTSD, we think of acute trauma, right? Like a one-time event. But then there's complex trauma, which is, you know, the trauma that you sustain as like in terms of repeated traumas over and over and over and over again. So I will say that for me, the trauma of having grown up under like the malignant narcissist who is my father, who, you know, is a prime suspect in this, certainly means that I have a lot to work through that people who were adults at the time and other people who knew her do not. You know, for them, this is something that they encountered, and certainly it was horrifying, and I'm sure shook a lot of people's faith. But, you know, I was essentially brainwashed through my entire childhood to be an agent of clearing my father's name. So over the past, I guess, I don't know, 10 years since I've been out of touch with my parents, like a lot of the work for me has been around developing in a totally different identity that's not based on being an extension of my dad's ego, not based on being like an object for their use.
Okay, so you said you've known all the details of this since you were 12. So what were the circumstances around you learning about what actually happened?
Yeah, so when I was 12, so this would have been 2000, we had moved to Germantown, South Dakota in 1999 from Pennsylvania, where I spent most of my childhood. So like we moved from a very urban place, like our nearest neighbors were like a half mile away. We lived off a gravel road. And so this was my dad's kind of first executive pastor job. Of course, like for his whole time since he graduated from Covenant, he was trying to get a job as a pastor. Of course, I think it's public knowledge that the seminary refused to write him recommendations for jobs for obvious reasons. We moved initially from St. Louis to Moreno Valley, California, where my dad, I think he was a ruling elder on their session. And he went to them with a complaint, like they worked with him on a complaint against Covenant about the way that they handled, like, I mean, they illegally tried to withhold my father's degree. They kicked him out of housing. There was like a number of things that the seminary did in particular that was, I mean, even if my dad was the murderer, like were illegal and like unacceptable and put us in danger. But in any case, they went and they kind of elevated this to the presbytery. And of course, Covenant kind of sits in a weird place where it's like not necessarily accountable to the General Assembly in the same way that other institutions are. So I know that that was kind of like, you know, without getting into the weeds on that end, the upshot of all this is that he was told by the session at this church that when he interviewed for jobs, he had no obligation to disclose that he was, you know, wrapped up in this case because no formal charges were ever brought. So he didn't. And so one of the reasons that we moved from Pennsylvania was, yeah, my dad had been working at this church job as a lay ministries coordinator for 6 years. And then his pastor went to, what is it called? I mean, a presbytery meeting, general assembly, you know, some sort of situation where they all get together regionally. And someone was like, oh, like, what's it like working, you know, working with Michael? Like, I don't think he did it. And David was like, did what? He was like, oh, do you not know? Like, yeah, like Mike is like implicated in the murder of Elizabeth at Covenant in 1990, which of course everyone in the PCA knows about, as far as I'm concerned, at least everyone in leadership. So yeah, he promptly fired my dad for, I mean, I can imagine like, you know, finding that out about one of my subordinates and being like, yeah, like you, I don't trust you, you know, in this position anymore. So anyway, that kind of instigated a whole period of my dad, like interviewing at churches. Like he flew to Hawaii and Alaska, like all over the place. He took us with him to some of these jobs so we would like sit in on these churches and like see him deliver a sermon. In any case, he did end up getting this executive pastor job at Germantown PCA in, was it Germantown? Yeah, Germantown, South Dakota. At the point at which the events I'm about to talk to happened, I think we had been there maybe like a year and a half. We'd lived in South Dakota. It was the winter of 2000, I think. No, it was just it was just after the winter. But in South Dakota, like, you know, snow is on the ground like 9 months of the year. So it was around March, April, like kind of near the anniversary of Elizabeth's murder. And my sister was walking to school, to middle school at the time, and people started throwing like snowballs and rocks at her, calling her the murderer's daughter. And neither of us knew what was going on. So my parents took us to this park. It just me and my sister, left my brother with a babysitter and took us and basically said, yeah, like, so when your dad was a student at Covenant, he was a work study janitor. There was a woman working underneath him named Elizabeth who was murdered. You know, your dad is the prime suspect. He didn't do it. He was framed. And they told me, you know, the details of how she was killed. I mean, they told me like a remarkable amount of details. They told me even that the night before the murder that like the two of them had gotten into a big physical fight in which, among other things, my dad dragged my mother around by her hair. Incidentally, I know we'll probably talk about this a little more a little later on. But like one of the things that was interesting watching the Cold Justice episode that I hadn't really put together anymore was that Elizabeth was dragged by her hair from the lecture room into the bathroom where she was killed. So, I guess they just kind of disclosed everything to me. And that then kind of explained like, yeah, like this is why we're moving into town. Your dad is not going to be working anymore. And so, yeah, for the rest of our time in South Dakota, after they kind of ran us out, he was a postal worker. And then we moved to Houston. And the reason that this was happening, big, big, important point, is that Donald, Elizabeth's brother, had flown from Edinburgh to Sioux Falls, driven out to the country, listened to a sermon that my dad had delivered sometime near the 10-year anniversary of Elizabeth McIntosh's murder, flew back to Edinburgh, worked with a journalist with an Edinburgh newspaper that I will have to... the name of the paper is escaping me at the moment. Oh, the Edinburgh Daily Record, I think is what it was called. But this journalist that he collaborated with a journalist to write about this experience of like going to the church where the man who probably killed his sister was delivering a sermon. And the newspaper itself faxed the article to our local newspaper. And I know that because I have a copy of the fax with the number, like, and the number corresponds to the newspaper itself. And yeah, like basically everyone in that community freaked out. They ran us out of town. And that's the point at which my parents told me and my sister about it, because they were like, well, you know, now there's violence happening outside of, I mean, not that they were self-aware about the violence that was happening in the home, but like, you know, now there's stuff happening to our kids because the community is reacting to this news. And they felt like we were old enough to know, which I don't think we were. But yeah, like, I mean, they shared with us a remarkable amount of detail when I was 12.
So then you guys moved to Houston. And then, so is this event, is it a part of your life in any way? Does it get talked about? Or is it kind of like you find out about this thing and you pretty much go on with life and that's that?
Well, like I said earlier, I mean, my dad, like the way that my parents sort of framed it was like that he had been framed for this crime, right? And like it was very apparent to me that it was my job as an individual to sort of sacrifice whatever agency, whatever power I had to sort of bring justice to this case. And justice meaning, you know, of course, like my dad's name being cleared in that case. And so, yeah, I had thoughts of being like, you know, like the Abraham and Isaac situation, being willing to sacrifice myself, which I think is like a natural way to feel. Like if you think that your father has been the subject of a gross miscarriage of justice, you know, that's made him resentful and bitter and angry, and then every day you're having to deal with like the consequences of that rage and that anger, like of course you want to fix it. Like you want to bring the family back to a sense of safety. And I remember that, yeah, he was always very derisive when he spoke of Elizabeth. He was very resentful at people like Brian Chaplin, who I forget the name of the guy who was president of the seminary at the
Paul
time.
Paul Koistra was president.
There you go. Paul Koistra, yeah. So yeah, like always, I mean, endlessly heard about like what pieces of shit Brian Chaplin and Paul Koistra were. The fact that I even knew who they were was strange. So it's certainly not something that we talked about every day, but it was certainly always there. Here's what I think happened. I think that my dad hated Elizabeth. I think that he had a really contentious relationship with Elizabeth. But I think he was murderously angry at my mother. And I think when this stuff about the memos came up, you know, just having had a big fight with my mom, I think he just misdirected that rage and just killed Elizabeth. I don't think that he had like a plan to kill her. And I think that when he came to her in that moment to have this confrontation about, you know, these memos that were between them, I think she gave him sass and I think it just put him over the edge. I think that most of his rage and violence was misdirected. Certainly, like, there were times where I was asleep and I was woken up to being backhanded across the face for, you know, obviously something that wasn't my fault. Yeah, I guess I'll cap it there. I mean, there's so many things to talk about in terms of just, like, the abuse, but, like, it just, I guess to sum it up, like, there was a period of time in my 20s where I just gradually came to see that they are just incredibly dysfunctional and incredibly abusive. And having some time away from them, it was like, oh, like, all these things that I never thought they were normal, but, like, it was so much worse than I thought. And, you know, as time goes on, it becomes even more, it becomes worse and worse for me over time, realizing just how objectified I was and how unloved and how completely alone we were, with no adults in or out of the house or in our family to help us, you know, with this person who was just, of course, I don't know if my dad killed Elizabeth or not. I mean, I wish I did. I'm pretty sure he did. But was he capable of it? 100%. I saw homicidal behavior from him my whole childhood. I have no doubt that he was capable of it, that he... And, you know, it was funny when I was watching this episode of Cold Justice, when they talked about how, like, he'd, first of all, written her, like, a very detailed, like, bullet point, like, list of, like, all these problems he was having with her, and then she sent it back with spelling corrections. I was like, yeah, he killed her. He for sure killed her. Like, that sort of thing would have absolutely driven him crazy. My dad hates women. And, like, this is, like, my broader contention is that, like, misogyny is the baseline of this church culture. The attitudes and behaviors and things that I have seen women in this denomination, like, go through my whole life are crazy. And in every case, it has been an effort to cover it up. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I have felt not only very frustrated for this over this case for a really long time, but, like, why I'm very vocal about it, because I don't see this as being, like, I mean, was what happened to Elizabeth terrible? Yes. Was what happened to her family terrible? But, like, what we are dealing with here is a much broader problem of this kind of behavior happening behind closed doors, no one else ever finding out about it. Like, the problem is, like, if you're a victim of this kind of stuff, there is no recourse anywhere. There's no recourse anywhere. The police are not invested in you know, helping children in these environments. The church is not invested in it. Like, I don't understand why that's the case. But if my experience as someone who lived through this is any indication, it's that people do not want to know. They just don't want to know. Because to them, if they found out that, like, if they found out how many of these pastors are homicidal psychopaths, it would actually make them, for the first time in their fucking lives, have to think about whether their faith is really rooted in anything. But people are not interested in doing that kind of analysis. They're not interested in being critical. They'd rather just sit and put up with it and watch other people suffer than get involved. It's my opinion that we really need to figure out on a social level what we're going to do about the fact that these people have so much power. Because as far as I'm concerned, we're never going to see justice for children and for women that are kind of subjugated in these environments until there's a broader conversation about how this is a bad worldview. It's bad. It's, like, bad to its core. Like, and I'm frustrated by the fact that, like, as a society, we've just decided that it's off limits because it's, like, religious freedom. And you just don't get to say that. That sort of thinking leaves so many people in the lurch, and it leaves so many people with unresolved trauma, unable to thrive, you know, just getting by day to day. I mean, like, I would say that, like, for me, like, people tell me all the time that, like, they're really surprised at how well I'm doing considering, like, everything that I lived through. And I'm like, well, yeah, like, you're only seeing part of it, first of all. Like, I mean, I live in a, my apartment is a mess. I really struggle with self-care. Like, I have incredible daddy issues. I have amazing issues with feeling worthwhile. Like, you know, I'm having my first feature film come out this year, and I'm working with some of the top people in my business, and I spent the whole time working on that, just petrified that if I made one single mistake that I'd lose my entire career. And one of the things that I'm learning is that, like, that, among other things, is a long-term, possibly lifelong consequences of surviving narcissistic abuse. And so, yeah, I wish I knew, like, what the answer was in terms of, like, solving this. But I just know that, like, being polite and, like, trying to kumbaya and, like, pray through this shit is not the solution. It's not. Like, people need fucking EMDR. I talk about trauma as an injury of community. I really believe that. And I think that, like, one thing that is exciting about being an adult now is that there's so much more research on, like, what happens to the body and to the brain as a result of trauma. And there's breakthroughs and stuff. You know, I did EMDR. It was really, really helpful for me. But at the end of the day, like, it's a profound mistake to say to someone, you have PTSD, so you have to go to therapy. It's like, a person has to be enfolded by a community. They have to have the opportunity to process. They have to have mirroring. They, you know, there's a zillion things that have to happen in order for someone to really heal from trauma. And another thing that's been, like, that's held my interest in this case for so long is knowing that, like, certainly, like, the things that I've lived through are terrible, but, like, the consequences to hundreds, if not thousands of people is immeasurable. And, like, the only way that all those people are ever going to have any opportunity of healing is if people start to say out loud what happened and to take accountability for their role in enabling this situation and to take real action towards changing the culture. And I don't know how to do that. You know, all I can do is, I feel like my biggest responsibility, or the thing that I can do, is I can talk about how angry I am. I can talk about how angry I am. I can talk about what happened. And at least now, with this cold justice episode out, like, now I can point to something, you know, because for many, many years, I would tell my friends about this case and it would sort of be like a feature of our relationship that they knew about, but it was, like, always completely abstract. And now to have something that's like, that someone can watch in 45 minutes and sort of get all the pertinent details about, like, what actually happened is huge, huge. Certainly not everything that needs to be told was told in that episode. But yeah, I find it unsurprising that you're having trouble getting some people to talk about this, but it's also disappointing because it's like people are, the lack of courage and the lack of integrity and the lack of, yeah. It's like, I mean, you know, for someone like Brian Chappell or Paul Coyster, I'm sure for them, it's just like, well, I'm fucking old. And, like, you know, my kids are in college. Like, why should I have to deal with this? And it's like, well, eat my ass. You know, that's what I have to say to Brian Chappell and Paul Coyster. It seems to me like the only way that this case will ever come to justice is if my father confesses, which will never happen. That will never happen. The man is constitutionally incapable of taking responsibility for anything. So does that mean that I think that there isn't something to tell? No, I absolutely think that, like, there's plenty of material to go after, even if this case is never solved. And in fact, like, one of the problems, like, I remember listening to Serial when it first came out. And of course, like, even at that time, I had been thinking about how I would tell this story in some sort of maybe podcast or docuseries format. And what I hated so much about the first season of Serial was, like, they just were so sure that they were going to solve it. They were so sure that they were going to solve it. And the whole time I was like, that's one thing. That's one thing. And certainly, like, I think one of the reasons that people consume true crime is because there's something engaging about knowing all the details and, like, getting into everyone's motive and, like, coming up with a hypothesis and, like, trying to close the case. But, like, the truth is, like, I don't have any statistics, but I'm going to guess that probably a vast majority of these kinds of cases are never closed. And so we're kind of left with a lack of closure on stuff like this. Many, many people are. And I really long for media that, instead of being primarily focused on whodunits, are really focused on, like, what do we do to bring justice to the people who never get closure around this stuff? What do we do to tell stories in a way that we can leave things open-ended at the end and it feels like it's still an engaging piece of work? The things that we expect people to do to heal from this stuff all on their own effort are insane. Like, the amount of money and time that I've had to spend, like, doing the personal work to move on from this is immense. And the overwhelm of stuff happening around this case has had just, like, profound effects on my psychology and my ability to function. I mean, even just, like, these last 2 weeks, like, yes, it was really good to see the Cold Justice episode, but at the same time, it's really uncovered a lot for me. It was the first time that I've ever seen any of the crime scene photographs or, you know, the blood. It was the first time I'd seen the interview footage with my dad. And like that was that the interview footage with my dad was the most spine chilling part, because it was like, oh yeah, like this is how he is. Like, this is how he presents himself, which is like, you know, he's very relaxed. He's leaning against the wall. He's talking with the detectives very casually about this. And in my mind, I'm like, this is not how a person whose coworker died under grisly circumstances conducts an interview. This is how a psychopath conducts an interview, where he knows, the thinking is, I need to come across as relaxed, because if I don't come across as relaxed, they're going to think I did it. That's how I read that completely. He looks so guilty. He looks so guilty. And you know, the footage where they go back and talk, I think it was like 2019 when they took the trip to Tomball to talk to them again. Just the, like, it's so interesting to me that he even said anything to the police at all. Like, they approached him, they asked him a few questions. He engaged on a few questions and then like walked away. And I was like, of course he did, because he's a narcissist. Like, any opportunity to like, to give his like 2 cents about how he was wronged and how like really the big victim in the Elizabeth McIntosh case is Michael. You know what I mean? And that's how it's always been. Like, my dad is always the victim of this case, because he was framed, and because Elizabeth was a bitch, and, you know, because the seminary framed him. It's just, yeah, it took me a long time to see how crazy it all was. But now, looking at, especially just seeing it all in that episode, it was just like, wow, like, it was just so obvious. Yeah, I mean, and there were many years where I was telling him, like, you know, if you have such a, like, you have a story to tell around this, like, you should write about it. And he would just be like, no, I'm good. In fact, like, one of the things I did at NYU, I think it was the Ensemble Project, where you had to develop, you had to think of a community of people as a protagonist who, like, it's a stable community at the outset, and something gets introduced to that community that, like, throws things into disarray. And, like, you have to decide as the writers whether the community dissolves or unifies around this thing that's happened. And I said to my partner at the time, I was like, I have an impulse to tell the story of, like, Donald McIntosh stalking us and framing, like, our church community and the community in, you know, Germantown, South Dakota as this community. Like, the article from the Daily Record being, like, this introduced element, and, like, you know, the fact that they decide to come together and do, like, a kill the beast moment for my dad, you know. But in any case, like, we presented this, and, like, one of my professors afterwards was like, this is the most thrilling thing I've ever seen presented in this program. Like, you're really, really, really onto something here. I had brought this home to show to my parents, and, like, in my mind, I was like, yeah, like, I'm finally telling this story. Like, the pastor character is, you know, like, at that time, I wasn't sure still, and, you know, that character was very sympathetic, right? Like, I was painting my father as a sympathetic character who was, like, in a very unfair situation, and my dad hated it. He hated it. He was not happy about the fact that I had written about that, and it was really confusing to me at the time, because I was like, how do you not want, like, If it is true that you have been, that this has just been a huge injustice to you, you should be desperate to tell your story, because I'm desperate to tell my story, having gone through what I've gotten through. And I had to really sit and think with myself and be like, why is it that every time I suggest he actually do something productive in terms of, like, write a memoir about this or speak to someone else, he just was uninterested in it. It's like, because he fucking did it. Like, he did it. And he knows that if he, like, his reasoning, like, oh my God, the reasoning that he gives in the Cold Justice episode, there's this, oh my God, he makes the claim that he looked for Elizabeth in the chapel, but he looked everywhere except the men's bathroom. And the reasoning is because she didn't like it when people snuck up on her in the men's bathroom. And I was like, she hates that probably because you've done it before. And second of all, you're both janitors. You know that she's going to be working in the men's bathroom. Like, the fact that you would go everywhere except there, it makes no sense. I mean, his reasoning is really, really shoddy. I mean, like, the only reason that this case has not been solved is because Creve Corps police officers, when they entered that crime scene, thought it was a suicide. So they stepped in the blood and they washed their hands in the sink and they fucked up all the evidence. That is why this case has not been solved. And you know, who's to say, like, all the people from the seminary who've misbehaved, like, I think that the cult, like, the culture of this is so embedded. It's like people are like, and this is the thing, people don't want to hear stories like mine, especially on a first date. I finally learned not to talk about it on a first date. But like, what I have found is, like, consistently the people who do not want to talk to me are people who are in similar circumstances, because in order for them to make emotional space, or, you know, listening space to hear me talk about what happened to them, they would have to actually consider that their relatives are narcissistic, or, you know, and or abusive, and, you know, and people don't want to do that. And, you know, I think that for a lot of people that have been in my life, a lot of injustice was justified by the idea that in the end, like, Jesus is just going to make everything better for everyone. I think that's an incredible cop-out. I think that if I ever heard someone from Covenant try to tell me something like that, I don't know what I would do. I would not. It would be professional and appropriate, but I would be very upset, because this is why I'm an atheist ultimately, is because I got so sick of expecting all of these institutions that claim to be about justice, that claim to be about truth, just at every opportunity subvert any opportunity for any of those things to happen. And it bugs me just how many people are so checked out from any responsibility they have to, like, humankind, because they are so invested in whether or not they're fucking going to heaven, because that's when everything's going to be fine. It's like, no, like, we are here now. If we are in relationship with each other and we live in civilization with each other, we need to have systems of economics and justice that support our ideals. We need to have those things, you know, and we don't. We don't. And one of the reasons we don't is because of the strength of, you know, the Christian movement to enshrine bigotry into legislation. I don't know. I realize I'm getting a little soapboxy here, but I just think that these things are also important to talk about, because I'm sick to death of these institutions never coming in under any sort of criticism, because it's just assumed that we assume that they're good. It's good that we have police. It's good that we have the church, because, you know, we just need those things as a premia facie or whatever, you know, like, it's just, like, per se a good thing. And it's like, I don't know. I wish it makes me wonder how many things could have been handled differently about this case on every level if people hadn't been so invested in the reputation and the status that they had as a result of being kind of high-level people in this denomination. There has to be some redemption of this, whether it's completely internal for me, where, like, whether I get to a point where I've forgiven everyone and I've, like, moved on and, like, you know, I'm doing well mentally. Or whether I get some sort of restitution, and, like, other people get restitution that they're owed. And it's not just me, too. Like, I think that so many people were harmed by this. How do you ever make it up to a person like that? How do you ever make up, like, the lost years of someone's life in which they suffered for nothing? What, for Brian Chappell's ego? Brian Chappell's ego is not worth that much, frankly. I certainly think it has no value. but yeah, I don't know. I don't know what restitution looks like, but I think that there should be some actual restitution beyond. Like, I certainly wouldn't be satisfied if there was a memorial or if there was a plaque. Like, I think that the seminary needs to really, really do some soul searching if they're going to actually go for justice ever. So I don't know. Well, we'll see what's next. I mean, would I love for this case to be solved? Yes. you know, would it bring me peace to know that, you know, if my dad was truly responsible for this crime, that he's behind bars? Yes. But what's true, regardless of whether he killed Elizabeth McIntosh, is that he was a terror at home. And there has never been any justice on that front. And so that's something that I'm interested in interrogating, is like, what does justice look like? And, you know, what does it look like for me to sort of finally make meaning of this and contextualize this in the broader context of my life and the things that I want to do creatively and professionally and personally? And I don't know. I guess we're just going to have to see.
So that's Carl's story. Now we'll hear from Carl's younger sister, Kirsten, who was the baby you heard crying during Jill's police interview on the night of the murder. One note, toward the end, you'll hear Kirsten talk about a letter she's writing to Helen, who is Elizabeth's younger sister. We've reached out to Helen to be interviewed for this series, but received no response. Here's Kirsten.
A little bit of backstory. As a child, we moved around a lot. I didn't understand why at the time, but my earliest memories are in Corona, California, when we were living with my maternal grandparents. And then we moved to Reading, Pennsylvania, right before I started kindergarten. So I would say, like, my most foundational childhood memories took place in Reading, Pennsylvania. And then my fourth grade year, my dad told us that we would be moving to South Dakota in the summer after my fourth grade year, and I was heartbroken. So I went from a very, very urban, huge elementary school to Chancellor, South Dakota, where the entire fifth grade was five people, not including me, and they had gone to school with each other since kindergarten. So breaking into that was tough to begin with. After fifth grade, we moved from, my dad lost his pastoring job in Chancellor, and we moved to Lenox. It was still winter time, but it was right at the beginning of the spring semester. So it must have been like January or February, but there was snow all over the ground. And I was walking home, and some of the football players from the high school started following me home and throwing snowballs at me filled with rocks, calling me the murderer's daughter. So understandably, I got home that day very upset. I think they scratched my eye or something. We had to go to the doctor's office. And that prompted my parents to take Carl and I. They got a sitter. Scott was not there. Scott was younger. He was still in elementary school. He had developmental delays growing up. And so I remember it was just me and Carl, and they took us to Sioux Falls Park. And I very vividly remember, like, hearing the rush of, like, the waterfalls in the background. My parents told us about Elizabeth McIntosh. And I would say whenever they first told us about it, the narrative was very much centered around my father. Like, you know, your father was in seminary. Someone was murdered. He's the prime suspect. And they've been hunting us down ever since. And all of this was because they had to tell us because Elizabeth's brother, Donald, had actually hired a private investigator to find us, flew from Scotland to listen to my dad preach in a sermon, recorded it, flew back to Scotland, and there was a paper published discussing the case again, naming my dad as the prime suspect. And ironically, I was 10, you know, so it's the decades. Every decade, something big would happen to kind of reopen this case and bring it to the forefront again. But essentially what had happened is Donald had, once this paper was published in Scotland, he had faxed it to the local papers in Lenox, and they published it. So then all of my classmates now knew me as the murderer's daughter. That was fun. So that was the first time I ever heard about the murder. And I honestly can't remember if my parents even mentioned Elizabeth's name. But that's the first time we heard about it. And everything, all of a sudden, like, everything in my life made sense at that point. Like, oh, this is why we've moved all over the place. It's like, as soon as my dad would get a pastoring job, he wouldn't disclose it whenever he was hired. And somehow it would come up. Either the presbytery would notify the church, or Elizabeth's family would track him down, and he would be fired or asked to leave, and we would have to relocate.
So soon after you find out about this, is that when you guys, you have to move from South Dakota to Texas?
Yes. We finished out the school year, and my mom pretty much told my dad because at that point, my dad was still kind of looking for pastor jobs. That's kind of why we stayed in South Dakota, because he was kind of seeing what other opportunities were there. And then after that incident, my mom put her foot down. She's like, I don't want to be a pastor's wife anymore. So my dad actually, shortly after that incident, he moved to Texas ahead of us and stayed with my grandparents to find us a house. And then that summer we joined him. So my seventh grade year was in Texas, Cypress, Texas. I would say my childhood ended at that park that day. Everything after that, once we found out about it, my dad didn't feel like he needed to hide it anymore. So especially in Texas, moving to Texas was like a huge defeat for him. And he was resentful. He was resentful of having to give up on his life's dream. So there was lots of him getting drunk and ranting about the case. And it was never, ever about Elizabeth. It was always about how he was ostracized, how he was wronged, everything that the police did against him. He was very much the victim. And he would get so worked up that oftentimes he would take it out on us. And I mean, prior to the Sioux Falls, they definitely were followers of corporal punishment. And I would definitely say the spankings were not always purely disciplinary. Like, there was definitely rage that came through, but we never really got an explanation as to why. But it was like, after we moved to Texas, it was just like, he didn't need an excuse to beat us at his whim anymore. Or he would find an excuse. Little things could set him off in the stupidest ways. So yeah, I would say my childhood ended at age 10.
How do you view your mother in all of this? The sense I've gotten in our conversations is that it's almost like they're in this thing together, but she's also sort of a victim at the same time. And it seems very messy and, all families are messy and complicated in some ways, I guess. But I mean, not all families have had to deal with this specific kind of trauma that you guys carried.
What you summed it up is pretty accurate. I think my mom and all of this was an enabler, a pushover. I very vividly remember, especially in Reading, we would have nightly devotionals where we would read scripture and like we talk about it. And like the most succinct way I can describe my relationship with both parents is in the story of Abraham. Like whenever Abraham takes Isaac up because God told him to sacrifice him, right? And he puts him on the slab and he's about to strike him down and God stops him, you know, gives him a sign to stop. And I remember we were discussing that story afterwards and both my parents made it very clear. They're like, we would absolutely choose God over you. If God asked us to sacrifice one of you, that would never be a question. And I was like, oh. And I mean, that was elementary. So very, very early on, I was like, oh, I am not a priority here. And that was very ingrained into my experience. But in an innocent way, like, you know, kids, they absorb this stuff and it's not, there wasn't any resentment. I was like, oh, just this is the way it's going to be. As we got into junior high and high school in Texas, and my dad kind of became unhinged. My mom would make excuses for him. She would support him in the gaslighting. She's like, oh, well, I wasn't there, so I don't know that's actually what happened. She was very much about making excuses for him. And it was very much in the way that my parents choose God over us, she always chose my dad over us, which I think is a very PCA understanding of a woman's role in a family system. And I think for me, one thing that was very earth-shattering for me is understanding, I think my parents broke in 1990. And I think that they have not grown as human beings since then. I think they are the exact same people they were then. They've done very little personal growth. And it was kind of evidenced to me about a year ago, maybe it was a little over a year, I was teaching at the time. And I very purposely went into teaching art because for me in high school, my art classes were my salvation. I didn't want to be home. So I signed up for as many extracurriculars as I could. And I found solace in art, performance art, visual art, all of it. And so I returned to the classroom. And I was teaching middle school at the time, too, which actually, ironically, is my favorite age to teach. I wonder why. I had a student that came to me and was just telling me about stuff that's going on in her life. Anyways, I was on the phone with both my parents at the time, and I was kind of relaying this story of my student to them. And my mom's reaction was, she's like, well, Kirsten, I know your childhood was dysfunctional, but at least it wasn't that bad. And then my dad chimed in. He was like, Kirsten, you can't possibly think that your childhood was dysfunctional, can you? So clearly this is not a conversation we're ever going to have, an honest conversation we're ever going to have, you know? My mom always chose my dad over us. She would very frequently gaslight us if we spoke against him. But we were also their marriage counselor. So whenever he would do things to her, she would come to us for solidarity. So yeah, it is very confusing and very flip-floppy. I would say my mom's view of herself in any situation is as the victim. So however that will suit her, either we're attacking her and her parenting, you know, so she has to gaslight and say, well, that was your father, that wasn't me. Or if he's attacking her, then she comes to us to try and rally behind her, if that makes sense.
There's almost there's a mutually beneficial dysfunction.
Yes, that's a great way. Mutually beneficial dysfunction. Yes.
Tell me about your relationship. It's sort of like the two, I'm sure, are inextricably linked. You know, just your relationship with your father and both your parents and your relationship with the PCA. But tell me what was your experience growing up at the PCA?
I would say, especially while my dad was a pastor, and in Reading he was an associate pastor, so still in a role of leadership within a PCA church. It was very performative. Not just my dad. My dad would absolutely take on this holier than thou persona the minute he walked through those walls. But he also expected us to perform, both perform because we are very musically inclined. We were the Von Trapp family singers, performing for church, but also we were expected to be polite and, you know, represent the family well and give people unwarranted hugs and let them pinch our cheek, you know, because we couldn't say no because we were the pastor's kids. So that's my relationship to organized religion in general. And as I've gotten older, I don't think that's specific to the PCA. However, I do think the PCA promotes some really, really dangerous attitudes towards abuse and victims. I mean, it's a little baffling to me now as an adult looking back. In South Dakota, when we were at the church in South Dakota, we lived on a manse on the church property. And it's just kind of baffling that to me that there was never any sign to any other adult around that, shit was hitting the fan, you know what I mean? For us at home. And I would say that's kind of my relationship with all adults in my life through my childhood. It's kind of baffling to me that no one did anything. No one did anything. You know, as a teacher, I had to go through training where I'm a mandatory reporter. If I see something, I have to report it. Otherwise, I can be held legally responsible. And I did. I reported anything and everything. And yes, that has hurt my relationship with some people, but I would rather be wrong than right, if that makes sense. So I hold a little bit of resentment to the PCA in that they didn't protect us in any way. In fact, I think they actively hurt us for the sake of appearances. And as I've gotten older, I am, in fact, an atheist. And I know that I don't like to broadcast it because I think people think it's me rebelling against my father or my family. And it really isn't that. It is, for me, going to church is performative. It's not sincere. And I just don't feel the need to live my life that way. And that was, even beyond breaking out of the PCA in high school and college, Carl and I, for a while, once we moved to Texas, our first rebellion against our dad was, you know, because he was very caught up in this, we must go to church as a family together. You know, we must appear as a family unit, a happy family unit at a PCA church. That was very important to him. And so the safest rebellion that Carl and I could do was go to a different church. Like, we couldn't not go to church. That was not safe. But so we chose to go to a different church than my family. And that was allowed, but not very highly frowned upon. So we ended up going to an evangelical church. And Carl, who is, as you know, brilliant, genius level brilliant pianist, he got into their praise band. And so I would get, I remember we would set up in like an elementary school every Sunday morning, and Carl would have to get there early for band practice. And while he was doing band practice, I would help with the chords. I'd set up the chairs. And all I ever got was, "You have such a servant's heart, Kirsten. You have such a servant's heart." Yeah, you know? And so I was like, oh, I'm getting out of my house and I'm getting approval from other adults for like having a servant's heart, for working, for being a hard worker. You know what I mean? And so I remember Carl left for college, and all of a sudden I was at this church like without him. And I guess he and I had always gotten so much attention that I hadn't made the connection that it was because of him. So like literally as soon as Carl left, like they dropped me like a hot potato, you know, like they didn't know what to do with me. No one was interested in me or my life anymore. I was like, wow, like you don't give a shit about me at all. Or what's happening at my house, you know, because now I'm there alone. And so that was kind of whenever I was like, yeah, I'm done. I'm done with this. Like, and I realized it's like the only reason I am here right now is to get the approval of these other people. I'm not here because I actually sincerely feel that there is a higher power that I am in communion with here in this space. It is literally to get the approval of the people around me. And that's still how I feel walking into churches. You know, it just feels... I don't doubt that other people have a sincere relationship with a higher power, but the whole like church fellowship thing feels very fake and performative for me.
What's been your relationship as an adult with your parents?
Right before I came to college, because Carl's 2 years older than me, so he had been at TU for 2 years by the time I graduated high school. So my senior year, our AC went out at our house in Texas. And my parents, in usual fashion, didn't have the money to repair it. So at this point, I wasn't relying on them for rides. I was getting rides with friends. I didn't have a car. They didn't teach me to drive. Whenever Carl left, they checked out quite a bit. There was hardly ever food in the house. And so I would just get rides with my friends to school and all the extracurriculars. So I asked my grandparents if I could move in with them for the summer. And I did. And I was working at a Pizza Hut, living out of my grandparents' house. Whenever Carl, I think my dad was traveling for work and it took him to Tulsa. And Carl had tried to come out to him in person. And so my dad left Tulsa and Carl wrote him an email instead coming out to him. Very thoughtful, very heartfelt email. And like a week passed, 2 weeks passed, and Carl called me and was like, "All quiet on the Western Front, like, you know, like have you heard anything?" Like, and I was like, "No, why?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, I sent this letter, this email to Dad." I was like, "Well, I'm sure I will hear about it whenever it's read." So anyways, my dad finally reads it. I was not at the house when it happened, but apparently he just read the first line of it and burst into tears. And my mom had to come and like read the rest. And they asked Carl to come down from Tulsa so we could discuss it as a family. And so Carl came down and he stayed with me at my grandparents. Like a week passed and my parents like didn't reach out to talk to us. And he like drove overnight. He literally like left as soon as my parents asked him to and like drove overnight to come down to Houston. And so like, and he sat around for a week like waiting for them to like respond, to talk, nothing. And so finally he was like, "Well, if we're not going to talk about this, like I'm going back to Tulsa, you know?" So finally I'm like, "Well, okay." So I remember we met at a Barnes & Noble and it was like, I was translating. It's like they would say things and like the other party, like could not understand, would get upset. So I was like, no, like this is what they're saying, you know. It's like they were literally speaking different languages. Anyways, so that finished, and I think I was on a Friday, because Carl and I went back to my grandparents' house, and the next morning, my grandfather had like an inductive Bible study that he asked for us to go to, and so we went to it. And then right afterwards, he is like, "Oh, I have to leave." I was like, "Oh, where are you going?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm going to go meet with your dad." This is very unusual because my maternal grandfather hates my dad. You know, like literally in my entire childhood, I've never ever seen them hang out, like just the two of them. It's always like at family functions. It's never, so very unusual, right? Red flags going up. And so he leaves and we call my mom. We're like, "Hey, like grandpa just left to go talk to dad. Like, what's this about?" And she just kept on parroting back, like, "I'm not at liberty to discuss this. I'm not at liberty to discuss this." I'm like, "Okay, well, we're done." So Carl and I just started grabbing trash bags and throwing all of our shit in trash bags, throwing it in the back of his car. And all of a sudden, my dad rolls up in the driveway and we're like, "Oh, shit." And we just scatter because we know it's going to be bad. And Carl makes it to his car and like locks the door. And I run into the house. And so my dad comes after me because he can't get to Carl. And I think I'm in a bedroom or something. But there were no locks on the door. So he barges in the bedroom. He grabs me by the hair. He drags me to the bathroom. And he is choking me against the wall. Whenever I kick him in the balls, break his glasses, and I run out to the car. We get in the car. We drive away. And I don't talk to my parents again, at least until junior year of college. What ended up happening, it was I still had like a week at the Pizza Hut before I'd given them my notice I was going to school. So we found one of the adults from that evangelical church we were going to, and they let us stay with them for a week while I finished out working. And at one point, I was working, and my manager, who knew what was going on, like came back and like, "Your grandfather's here." I was like, "Oh, shit." So I go out, and I sit with him, and I'm talking with him, and it's all about, "You have to forgive your father. You have to love your father. You have to respect your father. You know, you need to make amends before you go to school." And I was like, "I don't feel safe. Like, I don't feel safe. I don't know how that's going to end." Like, you know. So anyways, my grandfather volunteers to drive me up to school. And the people we had been staying with, I remember they were very generous. They like took me to Bed Bath & Beyond and bought me a bunch of stuff for my dorm room. We loaded it in my grandfather's van, and Carl was driving too, and I rode with my grandfather. Like, literally, we hit Tulsa, and we, like, pulled into a Brahms, and, like, we get lunch, and then my grandfather just takes everything out of his car, like, drops it in the parking lot at Brahms, and turns around, and he's like, "All right, well, I'll see you guys later." I was like, "You're not gonna stay?" He's like, "Nope, I gotta head home." And he just, like, turned around and headed straight back home. So luckily we had a friend with like Carl had a friend with a pickup truck that like brought my stuff to the dorm and settled in. But yeah, I didn't talk to anyone in my family for like the first couple years of college, and I didn't have a cell phone either at the time. So I remember they figured out my dorm number and would like leave me voicemails on my dorm number. And then at some point I decided to talk to them again. I think I was at college and I was lonely, and it really sucks I keep on missing the idea of having parents, but then as soon as I interact with them, I realize, oh wait, this is not what I'm missing. You know, these are not the parents that I'm missing. I'm reminded of what they are. And it is every time I speak with anyone from my family, except Carl, I feel like a little more than a worm. I feel incredibly unworthy. I'm like, and I only feel this way with them. I have like curated some really awesome people to surround myself with. And I don't know why I continue to go back to this whenever I know what it's going to be. And it's never going to be what I want it to be. So I was just done. I never want to speak to them again.
Going back to the incident, Carl comes out to him, but he attacks you.
Yes.
What is that about?
Oh, I had lied to him for years, which I will admit I did, because as soon as Carl went to college, and didn't immediately get a girlfriend, which is what happened for my parents. You know, they met in college, or my mom met my dad in college. My mom would ask me like once a week. She'd ask me, and just like, is Carl gay? He doesn't have a girlfriend. He's not talking about any girlfriends or anything. I was like, I don't know. We don't really talk about that. Like, we don't talk about sexual stuff. He's my brother. Ew, gross, you know? But my mom has this way of asking questions that she doesn't want, really want the honest answer to. You know what I mean? Because the honest answer throws her off the handle, which inevitably gets my dad riled up, and then we get hurt, is how this happens. So yes, I did lie to them about Carl. A, primarily because it wasn't mine to tell. And secondly, I absolutely would not have been safe telling them that. Neither would Carl, as evidenced by how they did inevitably react. But yes, I got beaten up because I lied to him about it. From 10 years old, my entire life has been shaped by the question, like, am I a murderer's daughter? Am I? And with the help of a really fabulous therapist, I think it was important for me to answer that question for myself so that I could move past wrapping my entire identity around my dad and this case. And for me, I think he did. I answered that question for myself about a year and a half ago, shortly before I cut them off. And part of what led me to that decision was speaking with the detectives in 2020, 30-year anniversary. they reached out to me. They were opening the case. They're bringing in the investigative team for the cold case documentary. And I spoke with them. I shared a lot of the stories I'm sharing with you with them. And they shared some info. I mean, like, they shared what they could with me. And it wasn't anything I didn't already know from, like, doing research with Carl on it. But I think around that time, taking all of that into my therapy sessions, I had to make a decision then. But I think what really solidified it for me was watching the documentary. Specifically, the reenactment of the attack is very familiar. There are several cases where my dad would drag me from one room to the bathroom by my hair and choke me. Very similar to what happened to Elizabeth. Eerily similar. And I think the other thing for me was watching his original 1990 interview and the way he... I think I talked earlier about his holier-than-thou persona he would acquire when he walked into churches. He would do that. He would beat the crap out of us, disappear for a couple hours, and then return in this holier-than-thou, super calm tone and just explain it all away. And it was exactly the same, like, cadence in his voice as in that 1990 interview from the documentary. And I think for me, like, I knew all of this. There wasn't anything in the documentary that I didn't already know about, but reading it on paper and hearing about it is very different than seeing it. Like, seeing the crime scene photos, seeing his interview, really solidified it for me. What I'm still working out in my letter to Helen, I think what I really want to say to her is, like, sorry. I'm so sorry for your loss, but thank you, because I think that if Elizabeth had not died in 1990, I certainly would have. Whether you believe that that is her spirit looking out for me like a guardian angel, whether that is just psychologically my dad crossed that line once and he was unwilling to cross it again, maybe it was because I was his family and it would be too obvious. He couldn't talk his way out of that. I think that if Elizabeth had not died, I don't think I would have survived to adulthood.
What now? Where do you go from here with all of this?
I'm really excited because I feel like this past year has really been like the first year that I have unburdened myself from this. Like, I answered the question for myself and I was able to form an identity outside of Michael daughter, or Carl St. Lucie's sister. I think that was a very necessary step for me. And it's very uncharted territory. I will say, growing up in childhood of narcissistic abuse, there are predictable patterns, even if the predictable is unpredictable. You know, like, I am going to predict that I have no idea how this is going to go, but it's going to be bad. But now it's kind of the opposite of that. I don't know. My husband is super sweet, super chill. he's a hermit. He is not interested in other people's approval at all, which has been really great growth and learning for me, who is a consummate people pleaser. And it's just been a matter of, like, my friend Kaylee put it this way. She's like, if you have something good at your home, you guard it like a dragon, you know? Like, you don't let anyone steal your peace. And that's kind of been my life philosophy for the past year. No one gets to steal my peace, and no one else gets to steal my joy. And if I live the rest of my insignificant existence this way, it will be well spent.
TJ, this was, I think, the episode that was most important for me to tell as part of this project, because it just makes me so mad. Just how the system failed these kids. I mean, multiple systems failed these kids. The seminary failed them. The church failed them. Their schools should have noticed that they were being abused at home and contacted the authorities. I don't know what could have made this all better, but it just makes me so angry when kids have credible allegations about mistreatment at home and aren't taken seriously. I see this over and over in my work as an education reporter. I know just from growing up in the church that there's many stories of kids who are not treated well at home. And, you know, of course, there's a huge range of that. But I just hope that anybody listening to this, if this resonates with you, that you know that there are people paying attention, that there are ways to get help. And if you have listened to this and it's maybe unlocked a memory, I would just encourage anybody to seek out help and see if there's a way that you can help. And God, like, I just have so much to say. Like, anybody listening to this too, if you think about a family who you are worried about, there are ways to kind of reach into that situation and be a helpful, useful adult. And everybody just needs to look out for the kids in their lives and help them. I can't even construct credible sentences. It just makes me so mad.
Understandably.
But yeah, I know that some people will be upset at claims that Carl and Kirsten make. But again, they're entitled to talk about their experience. And I just think it's really important that we listen to them.
I want to emphasize what Ruth just said there. It's important that we listen to Carl and Kirsten. Their stories matter. Over and over again, they were failed by people and institutions who should have protected them. Ruth and I have reached out to multiple people who knew Carl and Kirsten as children, and they all essentially remember the same events. Two separate people confirmed the story of Michael assaulting Kirsten after Carl came out to their family. Our hope is that their stories make people and institutions think hard about the present, the future they're building, and what can be done to change things for the better. It's also important to say that we are not sharing Carl and Kirsten's stories as evidence of Michael's guilt in the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. We've said it many times before, but Michael has never been convicted of any crime, and he's innocent until proven guilty. So with that, we've spent the last three episodes, and really most of this series, focusing on Michael's connection to Elizabeth's murder. But Michael wasn't the only suspect, and he wasn't the only person on Covenant's campus in 1990 engaging in questionable behavior. So now it's time to turn the page, to talk about other men the police looked into, and other theories about who might have been connected to Elizabeth's murder. Next time. True Believer is written, recorded, edited,
mixed and executive produced by TJ Ingracia. Co-written and co-produced by Ruth Servin-Smith. Research and development by Kyle Hackman and Doug Servin. Visit TrueBelieverPodcast.com to see additional materials related to each episode or to get in touch with us. If you're someone who knew Elizabeth or have any information related to her or her murder, we'd love to hear from you. Next time on True Believer.
Covenant got a very rude awakening when the murder happened because everybody's a suspect. So they background checked everybody and they found out they had students with very interesting backgrounds that they didn't know anything about.
I understand people get second chances, and a church will more than likely be the first ones to give someone a second chance. But they had some real characters.
We had someone come in and say, hey, I think he killed this person. But legally, we couldn't prove it. Like, there was enough to maybe raise an eyebrow there, but there was a lot of eyebrows to be raised in this case, period.